like the wands of Lady.
So there you are. You've spent hundreds of dollars traveling to a big city, a big exhibition. You've been wanting to see it forever. You get to the gallery, and 3 hours later, you leave completely exhausted, sore feet, sore brain, and not one of the dozens of artworks you've seen did you feel you really saw. But what can we do? How should we? How could we look at paintings? Luckily, Justin Payton, the head curator of international art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, has been thinking about this for a very long time. And Justin's written a moving and concise book called, you guessed it, How to Look at a Painting. Justin recently took some time out from looking at a painting to looking at a microphone. Justin, thank you so much for coming on to the art show. And I guess my first question is, why should we look at art?
What a wonderful question. Looking at it may or may not be an educational thing. It may or may not be a morally uplifting thing. But I think one of the things that it indisputably does is make the world outside look more interesting. Mm. And I think galleries are important in and of themselves, but they're also places you go to tune up your vision, to reload your image bank, and then head out into the world with, a set of lenses that will make it more interesting.
Something that I note with talking with curators and art historians and artists in general is that people talk about their old friends, going to see their old friends in a gallery again.
This is very true, and I am fascinated by this phenomenon of people coming back and seeing a work time and again. And I think one of the really moving things about doing that is that the object doesn't change, but you do. And that work becomes a kind of measure of how your life may have taken one turn or another and how you have grown. And another observation people make is that there are certain artists who they were not receptive to when they were younger, but they find themselves warming to, as they move on in years. And I think I heard someone say this recently of Rembrandt, you know, that they had always regarded Rembrandt as this kind of gravy brown old master. There wasn't much there that they loved. And at a certain moment, the pathos of Rembrandt's late self-portraits, which are, you know, the wisest and most unsparing examinations of what it is to grow old and regard oneself doing so, those paintings really began to resonate for this viewer. So, yeah, old friends. And the nice thing about, you know, working in and visiting a big art museum is that those old friends lead you to new ones. But I do think that, you know, I do love that idea of attending to one painting at a time. And having had plenty of experiences myself of staggering out of gigantic international art museums, you know, back to the hotel room for a Panadol and a lie down because you've just bitten off more than you can chew.
Yes.
I'm now fairly ruthless, and I say, look, there might be 5 things I'm going to see, or maybe even 1 thing that I'm going to see in this museum. And if you spend good time with one work, it is infinitely more valuable than doing a very grainy kind of tour of the horizon and coming out exhausted.
How do we actually walk through a gallery?
I think a key thing is to always ask what the art has to give you, not what it's going to take away. And this is it's easy to feel that contemporary art has it in for us from time to time. You know, not every contemporary artwork wants to be liked back.
That's very funny.
You know, there are works that are out for they would rather have a tussle with you than a loving embrace.
Right. Can you give an example?
To give you an example of an artwork that doesn't want to be liked back, there is a huge Lucian Freud painting in our art gallery, a wonderful loan from some international collectors.
So this is at the Art Gallery of New South Wales?
At the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And it's a gigantic painting of a naked man and woman on a bed in a very stark room under a single bare light bulb. And it's one of those paintings where if you watch people come around the corner of the room and see it for the first time, you can sometimes see them visibly wrinkle their noses or sort of rock back because it's so fleshy, it's so unsparing, it's so intense, and it's so deeply uningratiating. And I think Freud is a great example of the painter who does not necessarily want you to like him. In fact, I think he would have scorned the idea of being liked. I think you walk through openly, you walk through curiously, you walk through with your antennae up. I think there's no shame at all, and in fact, it's highly advisable to move through an art museum in that way. Mm. Look for that physical response, and it might be adoration, it might be arousal, it might be revulsion. But I think that those bodily cues, those almost, those ungovernable responses are exactly what should make us look twice, make us look a third time, see what the wall label has to say about it. If that doesn't correspond with the way you're feeling about it, look again, go and find out more. And then maybe on the next visit, look again and see how you feel about it. And I think it's through a kind of a layering up of those experiences that you start to acquire what the old-fashioned connoisseurs called an eye. And, sometimes talking about someone who has an eye for art sounds like a very lofty and, kind of class-bound description. But it's your eye. It's about the museum that exists in your mind, the things that you love, and the constant conversation you're having about with yourself about what you're going to take down off the walls of that in a museum and add to it.
You were talking about in the olden days and connoisseurs, and I was thinking about how, wondering, I suppose, how things might have changed over the years. Something that I've really noticed going to an art gallery now is how many photos people take of the artwork and perhaps don't always look at the artwork with their own naked eye.
Absolutely, I've observed it. And it's a great tension in public art museum culture because, of course, one wants people to enjoy the things they see, take an image of them, share it. This is all, it's great for audiences, it's great for foot counts, it's great for, the sort of social buzz. Mm. But at the same time, we're all conscious of this bizarre distancing that occurs as we kind of hover our black mirrors between ourselves and the things that we are looking at. And in fact, incredibly, the Louvre has a booklet which identifies the top 10 things to see when you're in the building. Ridiculous, really, as if the Louvre couldn't find more than 10 things that you could look at. One of them is Vermeer's lacemaker. And when you arrive at Vermeer's lacemaker, there is a queue of people to take photographs. And when I was there, I joined that queue, waited my turn, and then stood there not taking a photograph. And there was palpable grumbling in the queue behind me because I was sort of wasting the time of the people who wanted to take a photograph by simply standing there and not taking one.
You were kind of doing your own performance art, Justin.
It could have been construed that way. Mm. How to slow down, how to find that gentler cadence, and in a way, how to remember what a painting is and what it is there for. These are huge questions because a painting, as Robert Hughes, the great Australian art critic, put it, is a murmur in a museum. It's a modest thing. It's not going to leap off the wall and seize you by the lapels. It's not as thrilling as the content that is torrenting towards us through our devices. It's not as widescreen as the movies. It's not as immersive as VR or new technologies. It's this deeply analog technology which has been with us for so long. So there's a certain, you have to go to it. At the gallery, when school groups come through, and occasionally I'll listen to them talking with our educators, it is amazing to me that they will sit in front of a painting for, 20, 30 minutes, and bit by bit questions are asked, and they're open questions. The educators are not leading the witness towards the right answer.
Yes.
But those kids will get everything relevant there is to get about that work. And that's just because they are super curious, super interested. Their eyes are open. And they also don't have any, they're not anxious about saying the right thing. So if they are bored, or if they do find it gross, or if they are agitated by it, they will let that be known as part of their response.
Something that I've sort of experienced over the years is that I've felt an obligation to have an opinion about an artwork.
Yeah.
Is that a dangerous place? It seems like it's possibly not very healthy.
I think opinions are important, and I love it when people, when dealers or curators or artists have deep convictions about the works they love and they don't love. But it is a funny time in the history of opinions, because they are cheaper than they have ever been, and there are more of them than there have ever been. You know, you could argue that we are suffering from an epidemic of opinions, really. There's another discipline which has great value, and that is description, you know. And in some ways, I think the opinions that matter have to be earned. And as an art critic or a curator or a writer about art, the way you earn the right to your opinion is by describing the work in such a way that the meanings you think are there and the value that you think are there are articulated and that they travel to the reader, you know, they are communicated. You know, people will sometimes say, oh, that's just descriptive. But of course, description is always loaded. Even if you say, you know, it's a big boring painting that is read all over, there's a kind of politics, there's a morality, there's a set of values, there's a self embedded in that description. Because what it tells you is that it's not a very curious person who is looking at this artifact. So I think before diving into the opinion, set yourself that little task of saying, what am I looking at here? You know, how is it structured? What are the proportions? What's the texture? What's the heft of this thing? Is it inviting me in quietly, or is it pushing me back on my heels? Is it yelling at me in a loud voice, or is it doing something more subtle or musical? Just starting to think about the way the painting is made up and, doing a little postponing the impulse to say, I love it or I hate it, and just getting to know the thing. I mean, in a way, it's nice to think about interesting artworks as you might think about people, you know, not rushing into a judgment about them too fast. Not to think about quality, but to think about character. You know, what is the character of this individual work? What's its temperament? What's its personality? What speed does it work at? How does it lean? What's its posture? You know, all of that, I think, is the pleasure of looking at painting, and the pleasure of sticking with a painter for a long time as well, because you start to see the way someone shifts and alters across the course of their life creatively as they do as a person.
So ultimately, Justin, as we look at ourselves is how we can look at paintings.
Yeah, I think it's I do think it's a great way of understanding who you are and where you are in the world and how you relate to other people. Something I notice all the time in art museums is that there are conversations that people will have in front of artworks that they would never have if you just put them at a table and ask them to talk face to face. So there's this interesting triangulation that happens where you and I could stand in front of a painting, and who knows what it might be of. It might be a landscape with a cemetery in it, and we might find ourselves talking about the cemeteries we've been to and the people we've lost, and, you know, who knows where the conversation will head. But something about being in that public space, a public space for private experiences, and something about bouncing the thoughts back and forth between this third thing, this artwork on the wall, means that we are freer to explore bigger topics than we might ordinarily. And look, that might just attest to how sort of, you know, bottled up I am. Maybe I should be, you know, addressing these things more candidly in my everyday life. But I do think a great painting will sort of, it will flip switches and unlatch thoughts that, you know, wouldn't find their way into a conversation, you know, in the course of an ordinary cup of coffee.
Justin, it has been such a pleasure to speak with you, and I just can't wait even more to go out now into a gallery and test out your theories. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a delight to speak.
Justin Payton, the head curator of international art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales and author of the book How to Look at a Painting. It really is the most beautiful book and really very concise. I'd love to hear from you about your own experiences trying to see everything in a show. Have you suffered occasionally from art FOMA, fear of missing art? And also, what sort of conversations have you had, possibly with a mate, with a family member, standing in front of a piece of art? You can write or send a voice memo to arts on rn@abc.net.au.